Okay, so let's get started. Few announcements. First, there's a lab out that's due next week. Okay, so get started on it if you haven't already. There is a place to upload it on Spark. Okay, I presume most of you know what Spark is. Who hasn't heard of Spark? Who has not used Spark? Okay, so everyone has used Spark before? Okay, so the way the assignment will be turned in is you will make a zip file of your source code, a README, maybe sample output and so on, and you will just upload that into the Spark site. Okay, so that way your submission will be logged. If you are working on this assignment in groups, just submit one. Okay, but in the README file, you have to clearly indicate who constitutes the group, so we can properly assign credit to whoever is the person not turning in the assignment. Okay, do people need very detailed instructions on how to submit, or is this good enough? Yes, no. Anyone have questions about the lab? Other than the submission, which is still a week away. Yeah.
I might have missed it, but does our tree have to be balanced or can it get balanced?
No, okay. So the question is, does the tree have to be balanced or not? You got this question, right? Before somebody asked you this. Does the tree have to be balanced or not was the question. And I mean, we haven't specified. So really at some level, if it's not specified, the design choice is yours. If you take the extra trouble, you would appreciate it, but anyway, the thing is not going to be graded. So, I think it's more to make sure you know enough about Java to finish the assignment. So, I think it's okay not to have it balanced. Okay, when we give out the real assignment, we'll specify in a lot more detail what we are expecting. This one is, if you know how to use a hash map, etc., etc., you are in good shape. Okay, you heard the question. Oh, same question. Okay. What else about the assignment? Okay, so keep that in mind. I mean, we have one more week to go, so get started sooner rather than later. Now, there's another announcement, which is tomorrow there will not be a discussion section. Instead, I'm going to actually have a lecture. Okay, because I'm out of town on Thursday. So rather than not having a lecture, I decided to swap the order. So we'll have a lecture in tomorrow's discussion section. Same place, okay, where the discussion section is held, you just come to that room and I'll just hold a lecture there. On Thursday, come back here and Anthony will have the discussion section. So we're just doing it in a different order this week to accommodate my travel schedule. Okay? Are people okay with that? Is anyone a better room actually? So I prefer to teach there, but I didn't get it. Okay, so come to Computer Science 142 tomorrow. Okay, but don't expect our discussion. We'll do a lecture. Okay, I'll put that on the web page also, just so that it's clear. But since most of you are here, I thought I'll announce it. So the order of discussion and lecture is swapped this week. Assignment due next week. Homework is going to be put out soon. Okay, because we have actually, after this class, we would have covered the first two chapters of the book already. Okay, it's fairly early in the semester, but we are already going through the material at a fairly rapid pace. So it's time to start reading. Okay, the only way I can force you to read is to give you a homework. Okay, so that will make sure you will read the material. So I'll put out a homework. Homework questions tend to be fairly simple. The objective is really to make sure you're keeping up with the material and you don't wait until the day before the exam to open the book. Okay, do people have a copy of the book? Is it available here? So in the whatever the textbook places, or people bought it on eBay or Amazon? So it doesn't matter where you buy it, just make sure you have a copy handy. I'll put a couple of copies in on reserve in the library. Okay? Just so that you have access to that as well. Okay, so just quick recap of what we did last time. So we did a broad brush introduction to computer architecture. Okay, basically enough for you to know what we will learn in operating system and relate that to the hardware features. So this is the picture to keep in mind. Okay, so basically the picture of the key components of any machine hardware. Okay, so essentially there is a processor or the CPU. This is the thing that your programs run on. Okay, there is the memory or the RAM on the machine. That's where the code and the data of your processes are held. There's a network card, which is what is used for communication. This could be Ethernet, Wi-Fi, doesn't matter, but some form of a network card. And there are a whole bunch of peripherals. Okay, key peripherals include disks or the storage on your machine. Okay, then there are all these USB devices. They could be keyboard, mice, printers and whatnot. And then there's a graphics card and a monitor. Okay, so these are all I/O devices. They do either input or output or both. Okay, storage is key. This is where all your files are stored. Okay, this is what you use to do I/O, and this is what you use to print and so on. Okay, as a picture you need to have in mind. And then the other thing is there's this thing called a system bus, which is the interconnect for your machine. Okay, typically on PCs you may have something called the PCI bus. Okay, so that's basically a bus that is just used to connect peripheral. Okay, in addition, there's a system bus that connects the CPU to the memory and the network card and so on. Okay, so that's sort of a quick recap. And then we looked at several OS services and what hardware features are necessary for those services. Okay, and this is where the feedback, that the 1 minute feedback that you actually provided was extremely helpful, because it sort of indicated what were probably points that were not clear. So in particular, several people couldn't quite appreciate what are system calls. People didn't exactly know what I was talking about when I said traps and interrupts and so on. So we are going to go back. Okay, this kind of instant feedback helps me tailor what I will say. So we'll go back and do a slightly more deep dive into system calls today. Okay, hopefully with that additional material, some of that will become clear. Now keep in mind, this is fairly early on in the course. Okay, we are actually going to go into quite a bit of details into all of these. Okay, this was just the introduction, but nevertheless I'll spend a little more time on system call and traps and interrupts and whatnot. Okay, so but the going back to doing the recap, so a whole bunch of these services, okay, protection, interrupt, system call, IO and so on. And the important point was that for an operating system to implement these services, okay, you need certain hardware features. Okay, the presence of these hardware features makes it efficient for the operating system to implement something, and not having that feature makes it either difficult or impossible to provide certain services, protection being a good example. Okay, if you want to provide memory protection, you need certain hardware level features, so that if some process tries to access RAM that does not belong to it, the hardware will not allow it to do that. Okay, so things like that. So you need a variety of these services. So we'll come back to some of these things. Okay, so this is what we are going to do today. Okay, that looks like a much longer list really than. So what we will do? Okay, your question.
Quick question. It seems like we use I/O to mean two things. Sometimes I/O means interface with human, and other times it seems like it means interface with disk.
Yeah.
What do you mean in?
Yeah. Okay. So question is about I/O. So by I/O, sometimes we mean interfacing with the human, and sometimes we mean interfacing with devices and input and all. So here what we really mean by I/O is anything that a process does with a peripheral, okay, which is an I/O device. Typically those I/O devices are used by humans. So if the I/O device happens to be a keyboard, then there's a person actually typing on the keyboard. Those keystrokes trigger I/O to the machine. Okay, we don't really care about how I/O is triggered. It could be human initiated, it could be program initiated. What we really worry about is once I/O is triggered, how is that handled by the operating system? That's what we care about in this course. Okay, so it could be a person doing the I/O, it could be a process. Just the process writing some text onto a screen is also I/O. A human typing onto the keyboard is also I/O. So it means a variety of things. Okay, but what we care about here is how is the operating system enabling I/O, okay, to whatever device it is sent to. Yes.
Does it mean disk access sometimes? Or
yes. Does that mean disk access? Disk access is a form of I/O. technically network access is also a form of IO. It's called network IO. It's called desk IO. Okay, you could just write to the monitor. That's a form of IO. Write to the graphics card. That's for you do a mouse click. That's IO. Okay, so the IO is basically a broad thing. It's basically all the forms of interaction with the machine and coming out of the machine. Okay, all of that is basically called IO. Okay. Any other questions? It's a good question. It clarifies some things. Okay. So let's. So here's what we will do today. I mean, I'll try to sort of, this looks more longer than what it is. So what I'm going to do really is give a quick introduction to WhatsApp process. Okay, that's number one. We'll quickly run through some of these memory management, file systems, IO systems as a precursor to the real material that we will actually cover through the rest of the course. Okay, so quick introduction to IO, quick introduction to this, some other, not IO, quick introduction to what is the process, then a quick rundown of what is coming in this rest of the course. But for the remainder of this class, I'll talk about how operating systems can be designed at a very high level. Okay, what are architectural methods for designing operating system? There are four we will look at: monolithic, layered, microkernel, and modular. Okay, and this is independent of what specific platform it is. Okay, if you are set out to write a new kernel, okay, you have to make one of these choices. Okay, saying this is how my kernel is going to be organized. Okay, so we'll look at some of those details. Okay, so this is basically the table that I had shown you last time and just now, but with one more column. Okay, so here what this is saying is how do you go from the hardware to the OS to the user. Okay, so there are three columns here. One column is this is basically the hardware abstraction. These are the things that are in the hardware. This is how you use those hardware features to provide some services at the operating system level, and this is really what the user sees from those services. It is basically, so when you interact with your machine, this is what you are seeing. Okay, and what you are seeing is implemented by the OS in this fashion, and the OS uses these hardware features to implement those services. Okay, that's what this table is supposed to be. Again, some of these terms may not make much sense right now because we haven't really covered that material, but let me just quickly run through a few of them. Okay, so we know the first one should be a little clear. Okay, so here the hardware abstraction is the CPU on the machine. Okay, there's the processor on the machine. The OS service that is provided is things like doing process management, like scheduling of multiple processes, running multiple programs, the ability to do that, okay, which we call concurrency, notion of accounting, notion of protection. So all of these are process specific services that the operating system provides. Okay, what does the user sees? The user essentially sees the ability to run a program, okay, and thereby create processes. Okay, as far as the user is concerned, you just want to get your work done. You do this by starting programs, interacting with programs. When you start up a program, it creates a process, and the process uses some of these OS features. Okay, or the process executes using some of these OS level features or services. Okay, that's the way to read this table. Again, I'm not going to go through all of these details because much of it we haven't covered, so it may not make sense to talk about virtual memory and persistent and so on, but that's something to keep in mind. As to there is hardware features that are used to provide OS services, and the abstractions that you get are what you use. So as far as storage is concerned, you get the abstractions of files and directories. Okay, that's how you create and organize your data on disks. Okay. As far as memory is concerned, you get this notion of an address space. Okay, this is the region of memory where your process is loaded. Okay, so that's basically what a user sees. This I already said are processes. IO devices, these are the devices you interact with. Okay? Your monitors or terminals, your mice, your printers, you may have touch screens. Okay, there is sort of a much longer list than what is here. Okay, it depends on what kind of machine you are talking about. Okay. So with that introduction, let me start with the notion of a process. Okay, this is basically starting next class, we are going to go into this in a lot of detail, but let me start with the definition here. Okay? So what is a process? A process is essentially a program in execution. So you start up a program, it starts executing. That program essentially creates an entity called a process. A process should be distinguished from a program. Okay? They are not the same thing. Okay, is it clear why they are not the same thing? What's a program?
The program doesn't need to be running at the time. There's a process. It's a running program.
Yes. That's so. What is it? You said what it is not.
A program that gets the set of instructions that tells the computer how to operate.
Yep. Okay. So program is essentially a piece of code that typically resides in a file, which is typically resident on a disk. Okay, that's what a program is. A program is a source code, binary, doesn't matter. It's some piece of code that is in a file. When you start running this program, okay, then the program actually becomes a process. So it's a running instantiation of a program is called a process. Okay, so that's the distinction between the two. Okay, so essentially, a process is a program in execution. A single program might have multiple processes. You can start many instances of a program. You can start two instances of a browser if you want, or any other program. Okay, if you write your first lab, you can start it up multiple times on the command line, okay, on different terminals. So you can have multiple processes that map onto the same program. Yes, question.
Okay, so what you just said was that you can have multiple processes, each of which is an instance of the program, but can a program itself have multiple unique processes, all of which are
okay. So the question is, can a program itself have multiple unique processes that are all collectively that program? That's your question, right? So if you have a program that has multiple unique processes, that is actually called a distributed application. Okay, so essentially, these processes collectively form your application. Okay? So you can essentially have that, but then your program essentially becomes an instance of a distributed application. Typically, we assume, until we get to distributed systems, we will assume that when you start up a program, it maps to a unique process. A program can indeed map to multiple processes. Okay, then you basically, and each process may do different things in that case. Okay, so there are many examples. So if you use the Chrome browser, okay, so Chrome browser, when you start that browser up, it starts multiple processes. Some processes are responsible for rendering the browser on the screen. Others are responsible for fetching pages over the network and so on. Okay, that's an example of a program that has multiple processes. Okay, but we'll not talk about that until much later in the course. For now, a single program, when you start it up, creates one process. You can start the program up multiple times. Each will start a unique process. Okay, so many processes can be running. Processes are independent entities. Okay, what does the program contain? Essentially, it has this. Okay, it has the code for, I showed you a picture of a process or an address space last time. It has the code for the program and it has the data for the program. Okay, the code for the program, which is machine code, resides in the text segment. The data resides in either the heap or the stack segment. Okay, I presume you all know what heap and stack is. I'm not going to go into that. Yeah, but that's basically, and then it has the execution counters, which is all the registers. The program counter, okay, or state of all the other registers, which is stack pointer, frame pointer, and so on. Okay, collectively, all of this is the process. Okay, the resident code in RAM, the data for that program, which is also in RAM, and the set of registers. Okay, that is essentially called the state of a process. Okay, that's what is the execution context of that process. Okay, what is set up there is basically what kind of processes exist. There are many kinds. Okay, there are user programs, there are batch jobs that you might start up, there are scripts you might start up. Okay, there are system programs, okay, daemons that this operating system automatically starts. They are all processes in your system. Okay, different processes might belong to different users. Okay, but typically when you start up a machine, you may have 100 or more processes. Any questions on this? Okay, so what I had shown last time, I think I probably will just take a minute to show this again, was this thing that called activity monitor. It shows you all the processes. Okay, so I don't know how many there are on this machine. Okay, so these are all the executing processes, and then you'll see this is the name of the process. Okay, it tells you what program is actually executed by that process. Tells you which user started that process. Some have been started by me. You'll see that some have been started by the system. That's the kernel. Okay. The kernel is also a process, typically in any system. Okay. It's executing the code of the kernel. Yes, question.
So what's the difference between a process and an activity?
What is the difference between a process and an activity? Typically, they means somewhat similar things, but in this course we will not worry, use the term activity, we will only use the word process. Okay, so we will use the word process. Next time I am going to introduce the term thread. Okay, those are the only two terms we will use, because there are many different terms that somewhat mean similar things. Okay, so let's go back to, so I don't know how many processes there are. Okay, there are quite a few, as you can see. Okay, so important thing is program, rather not a program, a process is a program in execution. Okay, that's the thing to keep in mind. And processes can be created used for a variety of reasons, started by the user, bad jobs that are being executed, as well as system programs that the operating system itself starts. Okay. Now there are a variety of OS services to manage processes. Okay. The most important one is for the creation and deletion of process. Okay. The OS has functionality that allows you to create a new process, allows you to delete process, you can suspend a process, resume a process, all of these things can be done. Okay. So, and then once processes have been created, the OS will actually schedule them and manage them. Manage them, i.e. give them some amount of memory, decide when they run on the CPU, and so on. Okay? And then there is, it also helps with synchronization, okay, and resource allocation. So let's go to the very first task, okay? Creation of a process. How are processes created?
Well, when you run a program.
Okay, so that's the simplest way to create a process. So when you run a program, a new process is created. As we'll see next time, a process can itself create other processes. Okay, so that's also possible. So it's not that a human doesn't have to create a process. I mean, human meaning when a user starts up a program, you can create a process, but a process can create other processes as well. Okay, so we'll see all of that, and then let me just go back to this. So when you double click on some program, the operating system knows that you are trying to start that program, and it will start a new process. Okay? Now that's creation of a process. You can also delete processes, and you can do this by, for instance, variety of different ways. So here if you click on the process, so in Windows if you do Alt Control Delete, it shows you a list of tasks, and then you can end a task. That's the process, that means you deleted or terminated that process. Same thing you can do here. You can take this process, and if I do quit process, then that process will terminate. Okay. You can do this on the command line using what command? Anybody ever use the command to delete a process? Okay. So you can do kill. So let's kill something. Something that will not cause any problem. So we will kill Firefox, which is that process. Okay, so if you do kill minus 9, that's a command, and if you do this process ID, which is the ID of the process, it will kill Firefox. You will see that the icon is gone here. Okay, so it just created, I mean it killed the process. Okay. You can also suspend and resume processes, okay, as was mentioned here. You can suspend and resume. Okay, do people know how to do that? Yes? No? Okay, so I'll show you. So there are many ways. Okay, you can also use kill and actually send a suspend signal. Minus 9 actually is the terminate signal. Can cause send a suspend signal and suspend it. But here is another way. So this is an editor, VI. Okay, it's a process that I just started. It's running. If I do Control Z, okay, it is suspended. It's still loaded in memory, but the OS is not going to run it because it actually suspended it. So in the shell, if you say jobs, it will show you that there is this process that has been temporarily suspended. Okay, so now I could do restart it by saying foreground, so it will actually restart that process and here start it again. Okay, so you can do things like this to process it. What the OS is doing is it has a functionality. You are just interacting with it and having it do things for you. Okay, there are a variety of other things you can do with processes. These are just a few. Okay? So that's a quick introduction to processes. We will come back to all of this next class, which is tomorrow. So here is a synchronization example. So synchronization, as I said, is basically a functionality that allows multiple processes to coordinate their actions. Okay, then they need to coordinate the action for a variety of reasons. Here is a real world example of why you need to coordinate. So we look at a banking example and we assume that there are processes that are updating bank account balances, okay, for a variety of users. So there may be an ATM machine transaction, so that process has to go and change the balance on an account. You might actually have a monthly interest computation if your bank is generous enough to give you some interest on your balance, which most banks don't these days. At the end of each month, you will get interest. Okay? The way this is done is a process runs and it says what is the balance, and you get maybe 1% or 0.5% interest. Some interest is computed and is added to your balance. So all of these processes are going and updating balances. Okay? And while doing that, they need to coordinate with one another. You don't want one process to overwrite what some other process has just done, okay, and then basically destroy its work. Okay. The way this is done using this mechanism called synchronization, which again we will come back to when we do locks and semaphores and monitors. But that's a feature that the operating system has to support. It has to provide this functionality which allows multiple processes to coordinate, saying I am doing something while I am working on this, don't do anything to this account record. Okay, it's an example of synchronization. Okay, then once I'm done, then you can go ahead and do something. So there are mechanisms that allow processes to coordinate in this fashion. Okay, so you can take a lock, you can release a lock, and so on, as we will see. Okay, so that's another OS functionality. What we will look at here is first understand what functionality it is, and then we'll see how it is implemented in the kernel. Okay, that's really what we are interested in, not just the synchronization mechanisms themselves, but how they get implemented using hardware features and so on. Okay, so that was the notion of a process. I'm going to do a quick brush introduction to some other concepts which we will revisit later on in this course, so this is going to be a very brief introduction. Okay. Last time I was talking about memory management. Okay. Just as the OS has all this functionality to create a process, delete a process and so on, it also has functionality to manage the RAM on the machine. Okay. When you start a process, it has to decide how much RAM to give it. Okay. And it has to make this decision based on some notion of what the process will need. Okay. As new processes start up and old processes go, it has to reclaim memory that has been released, assign it to new processes. So all of this comes under the rubric of memory management. Okay. This is the functionality that the OS provides. Okay. Allocate space, deallocate space, maintain mapping of which parts of memory are assigned to which processes, and so on and so forth. So that main memory management. There's also this notion of managing virtual memory. Okay? As I had mentioned last time, virtual memory is this abstraction that allows you to essentially give an illusion of infinite memory, infinite RAM on your machine. You are not limited by the amount of physical RAM. You can start up many more processes and collectively they may take a lot more memory than is actually present on your machine. Okay, I showed you this example last time where I said, here this is physical memory, this is virtual memory and so on. If you actually click on this thing here, right, so it actually shows you how much, some statistics. Okay, this machine has 2 gig of memory. Okay, so it basically says 1.89 is used right now. There's some free memory. Okay, that's 112. But what is interesting is this figure. It is a virtual memory size. Virtual memory size is 175 gigabytes. Okay, that says that essentially this machine can pretend as if it has 175 gig of memory, not 2 gigabytes. Okay, so for all practical purposes, this is infinite. Okay, it's not really infinite, but I mean, if you have only 2 gig and you can pretend you have 90 times more, that you can start up whatever apps you want and not be limited by the size of RAM. Okay, yes, there's a question.
It takes longer to access that virtual memory than
yes. So I haven't said how this illusion is provided. Okay, the way it is really done is whenever you run out of real RAM, you used to take some part of it and put it on disk. Okay, and then you use that to do something else. So you are essentially using your disk as a backup to RAM. So essentially this is, although it says you have 175 gig, accessing that virtual memory, if it's not in RAM, is going to be slow. We'll come back to all of that. At this point, it's not performance is not the issue. The real issue is that this abstraction allows you to start as many apps as you want without any problems. Okay. Yes, that's a question.
So original array just start at RAM as opposed to, you know, using the caches as well?
What's the question?
Does the virtual memory start like using memory just at the RAM, or is it try to use the caches as well?
Okay, question is, does virtual memory use just RAM or the cache? Caches are typically transparent. You don't explicitly allocate or deallocate caches. Caches are directly managed by the OS and the hardware, and you don't count cache space as part of anything. Okay, cache, think of cache as a simple performance optimization. Okay, it is not used for, it's not explicitly managed in this sense. So the only thing the OS is directly managing is RAM. Okay, what to keep in RAM and what to keep on in this rest of this whatever 175 gig or whatever else we have there. Okay, which is basically that the remainder is stored on disk. Is that clear? So when we do memory management, we will see how to implement virtual memory. Okay, right now we just introduce what it is and why it is useful for users. But the real goal is you have to understand how does the kernel provide this illusion. Okay, what does it have to do internally to implement virtual memory. Okay, so that's again going to come up when we talk about memory management. Okay, the last thing is file system. Okay, so here, as I was mentioning, your low-level disk, typical disk is far too low-level an abstraction for users to deal with. When you create a file or when you hit save, let's say in an editor, you don't worry about, you don't tell the OS, go put it at this location on disk or anything like that. Just give the file a name and you just let the OS decide where to store it, okay, how to allocate disk space for it. All of those details are managed by the OS. So as part of the file system and storage management, the OS manages disk space. It allocates space to files. When you delete a file, it reclaims that space. It allows you to organize files into directories. Okay, directories and can have subdirectories and so on and so forth. Okay? It also allows you other features like protection. You can say this file cannot be read or written to by anyone. Only the user, i.e. me, can open it and use it. Or you can say this file is accessible to everyone. So you can set all these permissions on files. So all of those are features that the file system or the OS provides to you. So again, when we come back to file system, we'll look at this in more detail. Any questions on this? Yes.
Does the user really have like any control where files are put on the hard disk? Like if you make like a folder somewhere and then put some files in the back, could they be on like two completely separate?
Yeah. So question is, does a user have any control? Typically, user does not have any control. File system hides that control from the user. Okay? The operating system has, or rather the file system code has control, and it tries to do the right thing for you. Okay, so you are asking, if I have two files in the same directory, where is it stored? Okay. Ideally, it is better to store those files in a similar location on disk, because you put them together, you might access them together. This is not required. The file system can decide to put them as far apart on disk as possible, and that's still okay. But as an optimization, it will try to group files that are in the same directory, store them close by. If that sufficient disk space is not available, it will then put them wherever disk space is available. But user typically doesn't control that, which is why you don't actually see any knobs which says go put a file here. Okay, that is just not exposed to you as the user, and that is because typically the OS believes it's the task of the file system. File system knows better. Yeah, because so that's the assumption. Any other questions? The only thing that you need control over is where the kernel is stored on disk. The initial parts of the kernel. Those are actually always stored on a known location on disk, so that when you start up your machine, your bootloader needs to know where this kernel is and load it. Okay, so you need some control, but beyond that, the user files you don't actually expose any control. Any other questions on files in file management? Okay. So I already mentioned disks, we'll skip all of this. Okay, the last was I/O system. When we come back to I/O, okay, we'll go into this in some detail. I mentioned the notion of synchronous and asynchronous I/O last time, which many of you claimed you didn't understand, which is fine. Okay, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time trying to explain that again, because just a very quick introduction to a two-lecture material that we are going to cover on synchronous I/O, asynchronous direct memory access, and so on. But what should be clear is what I/O is. It's the ability for processes to interact with data or interact with peripheral. That's what really I/O means. Okay, that should be clear. Okay, how I/O works, synchronous, asynchronous, if it's not clear, that's okay, we'll revisit that at a later time. And here are some services that are provided. The first and the most important one that you probably have heard of is this notion of device drivers. Okay? Device driver is a module that you have in the kernel that is specifically written to interact with one I/O peripheral. Okay? So if you have a disk, you need a device driver for that disk. Device driver is a piece of code that allows the rest of the OS and applications to communicate with the disk, to read or write data to for the disk. If you have a graphics card, you need a device driver for that graphics card. Okay, there is a piece of code that resides in the kernel that allows you to interact, okay, with that graphics adapter and hence display images on your monitor and so on. And same is true of printers and whatnot. Okay? So that is one. And then the device driver itself implements different I/O mechanisms, whether it's synchronous, asynchronous, and so on. And we will again come back to that, so let's not go into the details there. Yeah, distributed systems I already mentioned. It's basically a collection of programs that interact, and essentially here the part of the kernel that's responsible for it is the network subsystem. Okay, and we'll come back to that as well. Okay, so now let me come back to the system call issue that people were not clear. Okay, so I'm going to redo a little bit of this material. So as I said, what are system calls? It is basically the interface that is exposed by the OS kernel that applications or processes can use to interact with it. Okay, that's the first thing to keep in mind. It is the API of the kernel. Okay, this is how anything interacts with the kernel, by calling a set of functions that you can use to interact with it. There are a variety of them. Typically, system calls are written in C or C++. Those kernels are themselves written in C most likely. Okay. I gave several examples of system calls, and I'll give some more today. But the more important thing to keep in mind is when you write an application, you do not program typically using the system call APIs. You program at a higher level. Okay, so if you write Java programs, you use the JVM or the Java API that runs in the JVM. Okay. If you write Windows programs, you use Win32 APIs. Okay? If you use C or C++ programs, you use the POSIX API. Okay, that's the libc and libg++ and so on, if you have encountered C program. Okay. Now, question is, why is it that user programs are typically written to a different interface rather than the system call interface? Why not just write programs that directly interact with the OS using the system call interface?
Did that when you kind of like taking over or taking the role of the OS, like your own hands of the program?
Okay, so typically, no, so OS, this is the interface that is exposed by the OS. You can always write application. You don't necessarily, by just calling system calls, you don't take over the role of the OS. You are just interacting with directly with the OS using the OS's API. Okay? So the question really is, why bother with these higher level APIs? Why not program at this level? Okay, yes.
For compatibility.
Okay. So if you then move to a different platform, if you program to the Linux API, if you move to Windows, it will not going to work. But if you return to the Java API, that will still work. Java API doesn't change across that. Portability is one. Are there any other reasons? Higher levels of abstraction. System call APIs are typically too low level to program. Okay? It's very cumbersome to program at this level. Okay, it's only one level up from assembly language. Okay, the next lower level to program is write your code in assembly. Okay, why would you not write your code in assembly? Same reason. It's too low level for you to write programs. You're going to do too much work to achieve some simple task. Okay. So you want, as far as the application designers are concerned, you want to program as high level as possible to reduce the work of the application program. The higher the level of programming, the less code you have to write. Okay, if you think of, if you know Python and let's say C or C++, it should be clear Yeah, you can do things in Python in a few lines of code. That is, a C program, you would probably write several hundred lines of code. Okay, so you're not programming at a much higher level using the Python API than the C API. Just as an example. Okay, so as programmers, you want higher level abstraction, so you can get your task done with as few lines of code and do other things, not write tons of code. Okay. So from a programmer standpoint, it's always easier or simpler to program to higher level APIs. Okay. And then what then you should ask, what are system calls used for? If you don't program using system calls, why are they there? Because if you always write programs at higher level, who, why bother? Right. So there has to be a way by which these libraries, okay, themselves interact with the OS. Okay, in the end, whenever you do I/O, regardless of what level you're programmed with, you have to interact with the OS and have the OS do the I/O for you. So typically what happens is, you basically have system call interfaces. System call interfaces are used by library designers to build their libraries. This is what JVM will use to invoke the OS. This is what libc and libg++ will use. This is what Win32 APIs will use. So user programs will call Win32 APIs or Java API. The Java API will basically run on the JVM, and then it will itself invoke system calls and ask the OS to do certain things. Okay? Things like I/O and other things. Okay, so it's not that system calls are not used. They are actually used. Okay, but you are using them indirectly. Okay, you are essentially using higher level calls which will themselves invoke this low level calls. Okay, that's the way to think about it. Okay, so now that's what a system call is. Here's an example of a Win32 function which I'm going to ignore. I'm going to instead show you a different function. Let's see. So if you want to look at system calls, you basically can use man, just not. Yeah, so here is a system call. It's called open, it's used to open a file. Okay, this is just to give you a sense of the interface. So here you have two arguments. Okay, this is C code when you call it. So the argument is a path, okay, that's the name of the file. Okay, and there's a flag which says what you want to do with this file. You want to open it for reading and writing and so on. So typically when you do Java, in Java you open a file, okay, your JVM in turn is going to call open. Okay, it will tell the operating system saying this user wants to open the file. Okay, so that's what's happening inside though. So if you program in C, for instance, if you do fopen, which is a C function to open a file, fopen itself invokes open. Okay, so this is basically how library methods or APIs sort of translate to lower level system calls. Yeah, because this is typically too low level for you to program. It is basically the raw interface. You will see that there are all these things which are flags in which tell in what mode you want to open a file. You don't want to deal with all of that. Okay, if you just say open a file, you want to just have the library do things for you. Okay, so that's basically what a system call is. Let's talk a little bit about how things are implemented. Okay. So typically any operating system will have tens, if not hundreds of system calls. Okay. The way the system call has a name, like open and close and read and write and so on and so forth. Okay. I showed us examples of this last time. And then each system call also has a unique number. Okay. That number identifies what that system call is to the OS. Okay. So typically there's a number associated with each system call. So what happens is whenever you as a user, let's say, calls a library API, the library API in turn calls a system call, you essentially trigger a trap. Okay. This trap tells the OS saying the user is trying to invoke a system call. Okay. And then you basically go into the kernel, and then you go into the trap vector and index against the number of the system call. Okay, that basically points to where in the operating system is the code to do what the user asked you to do. So if you invoke open, then you actually run the kernel and you execute the code for open that is resident inside the kernel. Okay, so here's a picture to show you that. The same thing that I had explained last time, but in a slightly different picture. Okay, so that's a user application. The user application, user is trying to open the file. Okay, let's say it's JVM, so then you basically call open. Okay. So this comes to the system call interface, because that's a system call. Okay, this is the boundary between the OS and the user. Okay, this is basically the kernel, and anything above this are user program. Okay. So when you call open, essentially it triggers a trap, or think of it as an interrupt. Okay. At this point, the user application is suspended. Okay, that process is suspended. Kernel starts running on the CPU. Okay. The kernel essentially gets an invocation of open from the user program. So what it does is, here is basically a table of all the system calls that the kernel supports. Okay. As I said, each of this has a number. Okay, so let's say you open a system call number 2. Okay. So then what you do is you look at the second entry of this table. Okay, the second entry is basically points to which where in the kernel is the code for open. Okay, so then you basically go there, you jump to that location, and then you execute the code for open. Okay, then once you are done with that, you will basically return back to the user. This is what is shown here. Okay, so here you basically index this. This is the implementation of the open system call. This is just a function that's executing inside the kernel at this point. So you execute open and then you return. When you return, you basically go back to the user application with the results of open. Okay, and then that process continues execution. Okay, this is typically how any system call would work. Okay, this table is called a trap vector. Okay, there's the same table I had shown you last time. In this case, all of the entries here are entries to all the system call functions that the operating system will support. Okay, is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so this is showing you the same thing in slightly different way. This is showing a C program in this case. Okay, so you basically call printf. Okay, printf, and you have a string. So this is basically going to print this string on the screen. Okay, so now the way your C library actually executes printf is that it has to call a system call, because all of this is I/O. You are writing to a screen. Okay, so in this case, this maps to the write system call. Okay, write basically takes that string and outputs it on the screen. You are writing something on a screen, a string onto the screen. So this C library here, okay, libc is going to itself invoke write. Write will basically cause a trap. You will go into the kernel. You will provide that string. The kernel will output that string onto your screen, or in this case on a terminal, and then your write system call will return to the C library. The C library will return back to your printer. So that's how, and the same is true in JVM. If you had equivalent things in JVM, this would be the Java process which would call the system call, and you will go in and come back. Is that clear? Okay, so now one question you should ask is, how are parameters actually passed between the user process and the kernel? So essentially what a system call has done is it has you called a function that belongs to another process. Okay, in this case, the function happens to be a something that belongs to the kernel process. That's essentially what you're doing. But there has to be a way to pass arguments. In this case, this string needs to be passed to the write system call and passed to the kernel. Okay, so you have to ask, how does parameter passing work? There are a variety of ways to do it. Okay, there are three that are mentioned here. The first one is, you can actually put the parameters or the arguments of your method into registers. Okay, invoke the kernel, and the kernel then goes and picks them up from the register and does whatever is needed to be done. There is one way to pass arguments between the user level process and the kernel. Put the arguments in registers, and then that's the argument of the system call go into register. Okay, but not all of the arguments will fit. In this case, the previous case, you could call printf or whatever, print line, with an arbitrary long string. Okay, you can't put a long string into a register. Doesn't make sense. Okay, so you need other ways to pass arguments. Okay, so typically what is done is, you basically have a special region of memory called a block. You allocate a piece of memory, you stick the arguments in that block, okay, and then you pass the address of that piece of memory to the kernel. That address can be passed through a register if you want. Okay, you basically, instead of passing the arguments, you put the arguments in a region of memory and then just tell the kernel, saying, go to this region of memory and pick the arguments from here. Okay, this is typically what is done in Linux and Solaris, okay, as an example. Yeah, there are also other ways like stack, but we'll not worry about that here. Okay, this picture I already showed last time. This is the picture that shows several system calls. Okay, this column shows the equivalent system calls in Windows. This one shows you system calls in Unix. Okay, they are essentially the same thing. The very first one in Windows is create process. The equivalent on that in Unix is called fork. Okay. This is a system call that allows a process to create another process. I just mentioned earlier, I will come back to fork next time. But I said processes can create other processes. The way you do this is you call, make a system call. If you write any program in Windows and call create process, or you write a program and you call fork, and your program executes, that program will actually create a new process. Okay, this is how you can create processes. Okay, and there is another one called exit, which allows you to terminate a process. There are several others. Okay, so that's an example. So here are basically system calls to create files. Okay, typically when you hit save in your editor, okay, let's say you are saving for the first time, what your program, let's say editor Word, is doing is it is actually going to invoke a library function that will eventually call create file. Okay, it will create a new file, and then you will store whatever you are saving in your buffer into that file. Okay, yes, question.
I just noticed that there's two writes in Unix. How does the OS distinguish between those two different calls? Or are they the same?
So they are actually the same write. There's only one write. You can use the write for a variety of different reasons. You can use, what this is showing is, in Unix, you have overloaded write. Okay? You're essentially using write to do file I/O, you're also using write to interact with devices. But in Windows, they are not the same. Windows, you have write console and write file. They're sort of, but here, you can use the same write because it's overloaded. It knows what the right thing is to do. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So now with that introduction to system calls, I'm going to go back to that OS organization. Okay, so it's sort of switching topics a little bit. So now the broad question is, you want to design a new kernel. What kind of architecture would you choose for your kernel? Okay, so we'll look at four different ways to organize kernels. First one is called monolithic organization. That's basically what is shown in this picture. Yeah, this is what early operating system did. The code, and so in a monolithic kernel, all of the code for your process, or not your process, for the kernel, is one big blob of code. It's basically, there's no particular organization, it's just one large piece of code. Okay? That code might be doing a variety of different things, and here are all the things an operating system kernel has to do. Okay, it has to expose a system call interface, it has to implement a file system, it has to do CPU scheduling, it has to do memory management, it has to implement virtual memory, it has to interact with devices. So kernel has to do a variety of different tasks. Okay, in a monolithic kernel, you just write code to do all of those tasks as one large program, and you're done. Okay, this organization is essentially what is called a monolithic kernel. Okay, so I think it's... So you should ask the question, what are the advantages and disadvantages of this organization? So let's start with disadvantages. If you have any large software system that is basically doesn't really have an architecture, is one big blob of code, what disadvantages do you see of writing your system in this way? Yeah. It's hard to maintain and debug. If something goes wrong, you don't know what exactly went wrong. Okay? And then if you actually track down the bug and you fix it, you don't know what side effects this bug can have, because all one large piece of code, you might change something here, it might cause unintended side effects somewhere else. Okay? Hard to maintain. It's nothing to do with kernels, it's a standard software engineering principle. It's nothing to do with operating system. Any large code, if you have any software system that is tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of lines of code, you don't have any modularity in that system, you are asking for trouble in terms of maintenance. Yeah, in terms of troubleshooting, debugging, fixing bugs, you might have lots of problems. Okay. So clearly, monolithic kernels are hard to maintain. Okay, that's a single big disadvantage. What are some advantages? Is there any advantage of doing it this way? Yeah.
Maybe it's faster.
faster. Why is it faster? Okay. So if you, so that's right. So the monolithic kernels are efficient. They are fast. Okay. Why are they fast? Because there is no boundary between components. Okay, there's no overhead in crossing those boundaries. Any piece here can call any other code by just making a function call. Okay, function call is the most efficient way for any piece of code to call something else in that process. A single function call allows a virtual memory module to talk to the CPU scheduler, for the file system to call, talk to the CPU scheduler, and so on and so forth. Okay. So this is the only reason why monolithic kernels even exist, because for many systems, performance is key. You don't want your system to be slow. You don't want to use your system if it is slow. Yeah, so you have to take shortcuts like this. But clearly, modern operating systems don't have this architecture, but early kernels look like this. And those were not very large, so it was okay to have them as monolithic pieces. Okay, as the kernels became bigger and bigger, this doesn't scale. It doesn't work when your kernel is 100 million lines of code. Okay, so monolithic kernel is the first organization. Okay, you use it only if you want performance, but then your maintenance is a nightmare. The next organization is layered design. In layered design, there's a picture there. Each component of the kernel is put in a particular layer. Okay, so here you have CPU scheduler is a layer, IO channel is a layer, virtual memory is a layer. That's a component of the kernel. Okay, and what we have done in the layered design is we have put restrictions on how the components or which components can talk to which others. In particular, in the layer design, layer I, any layer I, let's say layer 2, can only talk to the layer above it and the layer below it. No other layers. Okay, so in this case, we'll say virtual memory layer. It can only talk to the device driver layer, it can talk to the IO channel. A virtual memory layer cannot directly communicate with the CPU scheduler. Okay, it can only communicate indirectly via intermediate layer. So you can only layer N can only talk to layer n minus 1 and n plus 1. Okay, so you can only talk to layers above it and below it. Okay, now question is, what does this give you? What are the disadvantages? Advantages, first, you have modularized the kernel. You are forced to put functionality into a particular layer. That layer is a module of some sort. Okay, it is easier to design and debug, because if you make a change to a layer, you are guaranteed that the only things that will be impacted by this change is the layer above it and the layer below it, because you don't interact with anything else. Okay, those are the only two things in the kernel that interact with this layer. So if at all something breaks because you made a change, it should be clear that things will only break in the layer above it or the layer below it or this layer itself, and nothing else. In a monolithic kernel, you make a change, anything can be impacted, because you don't know what else is actually depending on this piece of code. Is that clear? Yes or no? Not saying yes or no doesn't help. Okay, that's clear. Okay. Now, this is actually a contrived figure. Okay, no kernel is actually built this way. Okay, so in fact, that doesn't even make any sense the way it's been drawn. But there are parts of the kernel that actually use the layer design. There are no kernels that entirely use the layer design, but there's one key component of the kernel that actually uses this organization, and that piece is the network subsystem in the kernel. Okay? The TCP/IP stack actually uses a layered organization. Okay, anybody take 453?
This is a prerequisite,
sir. Okay. So you can be taking it now, but not before. Okay, that makes sense. So there is a reason. So the network subsystem, actually all network subsystem, in particular the most popular one being TCP/IP, the code is actually written in this way. Okay, and I should use a figure here, the real figure of layered organization. So the way the network stack is written, so as you know, probably heard TCP/IP. So what you have, there's something called the TCP layer, there's something called the IP layer, something called the MAC layer, something called the physical layer. And they can have the app, and so on. Okay. So this organization is a layered organization. At the very bottom here, you have the physical layer. That's the hardware device. That could be your Ethernet device, it could be your Wi-Fi device, it could be your 3G or the Bluetooth device, whatever the device is for communication, that is basically at the bottom, okay, the hardware. What runs above it is what's called a MAC layer. This is in most cases, this is things like Ethernet. The Ethernet driver essentially sits at this layer. Okay. What runs on top of Ethernet is what is called IP. It is part of TCP/IP. This IP layer also called a network layer. What sits on top of this is called a transport layer. Okay. Most common transport protocol is TCP/IP. There's another one called UDP. Not TCP/IP, it's TCP. Another one called UDP. And then there's application layer. This is where application level protocols reside, which is FTP, HTTP, SMTP, and so on and so forth. Those are at the application layer. Okay. So this entire network subsystem stack is written in this layered fashion. And the reason it is written in this fashion is the way the network stack is constructed, particular layer is restricted from only talking to the layer above it and the layer below it. It cannot talk to any other layer in the stack. Okay. And this is how network packets are sent and received. So it makes sense to actually impose this restriction. The way typically things work is, let's say you have a browser here. Okay, you have your Firefox or whatnot. You click on a link. Okay, when you click on a link, your browser constructs what is called an HTTP request. Okay, so you basically hand that link to the HTTP protocol or the HTTP layer. The HTTP protocol basically tells the TCP layer saying go connect to that server somewhere. Okay, so basically the HTTP request is sent down to TCP saying go ahead and connect to the other end. What TCP will do is it will take that packet and it will send it to IP saying send it to all the routers in the network to the other end. Now IP essentially is called a network layer. It is responsible for something called routing. Okay, routing essentially allows a network packet to hop from one node to another, one router to another, until it gets to its destination. Okay. So IP will then hand it, in this case, to the Ethernet layer, saying, okay, send this out on the wire so it can actually reach the other router. So the Ethernet layer will send it to the device will actually send out the bits on the wire, they will arrive at the next hop, okay, whatever you have connected your machine to, then there, basically there, IP will take that packet, it will traverse up the stack, IP will send it to the next hop and so on, until it reaches the destination. At some point your web browser request is received at the web server, it arrives at the Ethernet layer. Okay. Ethernet basically layer is going to hand that to the driver. So here is a new packet that just arrived over the network. Okay. Driver will send it off to IP. So here is a packet. The IP will say, okay, this packet has actually arrived at the right destination, nothing more to do. Hand it to TCP, TCP will hand it to HTTP, HTTP will hand that to the web server. Okay, then web server will take your request and do something with it, construct a response, the response will actually go down the stack, go over the network, arrive at the other end. Okay? Because communication actually occurs in this fashion, it makes sense to write your network subsystem in a layered fashion. Okay, so this is not supposed to be a course on networking, so we'll not go into any of those details. The only thing to keep in mind is layered organization is only used in the network subsystem. It doesn't make sense to impose that restriction on the entire kernel. The restriction being who can communicate, which layer can communicate to which other layers. Any questions on this? Next organization, there are two more, and then we'll be done for the day. The next organization for the kernel is what is called a microkernel architecture. It's the exact opposite of the monolithic kernel. In the monolithic kernel, all the OS functionality was crammed into one piece of code. Okay? And there's one big blob of code that executes. The microkernel architecture, as the name suggests, what is actually the kernel is a very small piece of code that only provides some very minimal functionality. Okay? And everything else that the operating system typically needs to do actually runs as a system process, as a user level process. Okay? And user level process communicate with one another via the microkernel. So here is an example that this is the microkernel. It does very low level things. It provides protection, it provides communication. Okay? The file system is implemented as a user level process. Okay? your thread system is implemented as user level process. Scheduling is implemented as a user level process. The network subsystem, the entire TCP/IP stack is implemented as a user level process. The actual processes, okay, that run as user processes. Okay. And the way they work is they communicate with one another to do whatever the OS would normally have done. Okay. So this organization is referred to as the microkernel organization. So the question is, what does this give you and why do it this way? Essentially what you are saying is the way you want to build your large software system is construct a collection of processes. Each process does a very specific task and processes can talk to one another. Instead of writing one large piece of code where the whole thing is crammed into one process, separate all of the components, so each of them runs in their own process, and then you have this one thing at the very bottom, which is allowing these processes to communicate, to talk to one another, interact with one another. So what does this give us? Why bother?
Seems like there's a lot of overhead, but it'd be like a lot faster.
Do you say it's faster or not faster?
It seems faster.
It seems faster. Why is it faster?
Because like everything's already loaded in memory, I would assume, so you could just do a very quick call.
But that would be true even for monolithic kernel, right? So we are just comparing microkernel with monolithic. So assume that all of this code is loaded in memory, all of that code is loaded in memory. So now, is it faster, slower, same, doesn't matter? Okay, so one suggestion is that microkernel is going to be slower because if this file system needs to talk to the CPU scheduler for whatever reason, it has to actually send a request via the microkernel. Request comes here, it goes back up. Okay, so that is the premise or the suggestion is that is going to slow things down. Okay, yes, you have something more. Sorry, kernel processes are what? Are smaller, yes. Yes. So it is true that each of this is going to have a much smaller piece of code than a monolithic kernel, but there is a lot of communication. True. Okay, so thus far all we have heard is disadvantages. Why? What are the advantages? Why would we bother? Okay, so software engineering is one suggestion. It's easier to manage a microkernel than a big piece of code. Yeah.
It also allows for more portability and compatibility. If you want to have your operating system support 10 different file systems, you can just by adding a new system process for whatever other file system you want. Whereas if it's baked straight into the macrokernel, that means that you need to either put that file system into the kernel.
Okay.
Can't have it.
So portability, some hand up here. Somewhere. Okay. Anything else? Any other suggestions or thoughts? Security. Better security because these are all processes. They're all by definition processes are isolated from one another. Malicious hacker finds a bug in the network subsystem, okay, cannot get to the file system because that's a separate piece of code. Okay, so it's also better security. So there, all of these whatever things have been said are right. So advantages: better, more reliability, easier to debug, easier to maintain, okay, easier to extend. So if you want to change the file system, as was pointed out, you just replace this process. Okay, if so long as it uses the same API. Okay. Nothing else in the kernel has changed. You don't even have to recompile the rest of the kernel. So you made a change, only recompile this component because it's own independent process. Okay. So lots of advantages of this modular. It's a highly modular architecture. Okay. So lots of advantages. All of what was said is true. Disadvantages are also what were mentioned, that it is going to be really slow. Okay. What was a function call in the monolithic architecture requires you to send a message in the microkernel architecture. a function calls are very quick. You just call a function, you return. In this case, rather than the file system, I'm making a function call to, let's say, the network subsystem. Okay. You have to send a message. The message comes from here to here. It goes back. Okay. That's almost an order of magnitude slower. So any time components of the kernel have to interact with one another, you slow things down tremendously. Okay, so there was a movement in the 80s to go from the monolithic to a microkernel architecture. Okay, then when the performance problem became apparent, then the movement unrolled. Okay, so actually there are many commercial operating systems as well as research ones that use this. The earliest one that actually came up with this idea was something called MACH. Okay, this was an operating system that was designed, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s at CMU. Okay, and that is where they proposed this architecture. And it influenced a number of commercial systems. Okay, so Windows NT, the predecessor of all the modern versions of Windows, used a microkernel architecture. Okay, Windows NT 1 and 2 actually used this. Okay, it was so slow that nobody really wanted to use it. Okay, so then what they started doing is they said, okay, performance is a problem, what do we do? They started taking these pieces and moved them back. Okay, so this piece talks to that piece a lot, let's put both of them in the kernel. And then soon you start going back to what was a monolithic architecture. So now today, what you have is again a movement backwards, okay, from microkernel to monolithic. Okay, OS X was also based on MACH. Okay, it actually turns out that both Windows and OS X actually are the same roots. Okay, they all came from MACH. The designer of MACH actually went to Microsoft, and he was essentially the architect of Windows NT. So Windows NT was heavily influenced by MACH. Then MACH also went into Unix and BSD, and then OS X derived its roots from BSD. Okay, so the bottom layer of OS X, even today, okay, is MACH. Okay, but OS X is by no means a microkernel architecture, because they've gone back and put so much stuff back into the kernel on top of MACH that it's essentially, for all practical purposes, not a microkernel architecture. Okay, so if you actually look at your system directory on a Mac, you will actually see the kernel is actually, even the name has not changed. Okay, well, that's a 30-year-old kernel that it's based on. It's the MACH kernel. Okay, same is true of Windows NT, but I'm presuming by now all traces of MACH have disappeared from Windows. Okay, but at least the name stays in OS X. Okay, so that's microkernel architecture. So I said there was CMU, MACH, and at the same time there were a number of others that were exploring the same thing. There was one called Hydra and Chorus and so on. Okay, so that's basically not used anymore. This is what today's OS X looks like. The bottom is still a microkernel, but they've gone and put a whole bunch of stuff back in. Okay, in particular, BSD has gone back in. Okay, that's most of the kernel subsystem that was outside. Okay, in the microkernel, they're all running as user processes. They've all been put back. Okay, so architecturally, there's still a distinction, but now the communication is no longer IPC. It is just function calls again. Okay, but the layering is still there. A little bit of that layering that I was talking about earlier. So all of that is there. Okay, so if you actually program, if you do low-level OS X programming, you have multiple interfaces. You can write to what is called the MACH layer, you can write to the BSD layer. There are a number of higher-level abstractions, IOKit and whatnot, in OS X. Okay, this is basically because all the legacy stuff is still there, those interfaces are still there, but Apple has continued to build higher-level, better interfaces, okay, to write your device drivers and other kernel subsystems. And I'll show an example of this in just a moment. Okay. So like the last organization is what is called a modular organization. This one uses an object-oriented like approach, best illustrated with a picture. Okay, this is what the modern incarnation of what was the microkernel has become. Okay, so rather than having components that run as separate user processes, you still have those components for software engineering purposes. Okay, and these components are called modules, but they all run within the context of a single user process for performance reasons. So at the very core, you have a small kernel. we will not call it a microkernel, but it's a small kernel, and that kernel is extended by a sequence of modules. Device drivers are modules, everything that you know of is a module. And they extend the functionality of the core kernel. But the difference between the microkernel and a modular kernel is that all of these things actually run within the same address space. In a microkernel, each of these pieces would have run as a separate user process that is distinct from the kernel. So that's the only difference. Other than that, from a software engineering perspective, we try to retain the advantages of the microkernel architecture, but while trying to overcome the limitation. All operating systems today use some form of modularity, be it Linux or Windows or OS X. You basically have in Linux, you have the core kernel and you have a bunch of modules. In OS X, you have the core kernel and a bunch of modules. It's the same kind of stuff. So I'll show you. You can actually look what modules are typically loaded. It has a command for it called, I think, something like KX kernel extension stats. Okay, so this shows you a long list of modules that are, the list goes on and on. Okay, so here is the actual kernel. Okay, that's Mach. You'll see that's the kernel API of Mach, and this would be BSD. So that's the BSD subsystem. So that layering I was talking about, so there's Mach here, there's the BSD subsystem, they're all within the same kernel address space. Okay, this is IOKit. IOKit is basically the device driver API. This is what you write device drivers against. Okay, and then you'll see a very long list of device drivers that are all loaded. So you can keep going on and on here. Here is the USB audio device driver. It's the multi-touch driver. So it'll say apple.driver.multi-touch. Here is the file system. There is also a module. It's a here is I think that's VMware's driver. There are a whole bunch of others. Okay, so there is a Bluetooth driver there, and if you look at all this, you'll see a whole bunch of them. Okay, in Linux, if you do ls mod, you will actually see all the modules that are loaded. Same command, but different, shows you the same kind of stuff. Okay. So typically today's kernel, what this is showing is there's a kernel and there will be like 30 modules. They all extend the functionality of the kernel. There's a module, there's a device driver, is a module, file systems are modules. Modules can be loaded and unloaded on the fly. Okay. So it allows you high degree of modularity, but you don't have any of the disadvantages of your microkernel architecture. Okay. That is essentially your modular operating system. Okay, so I said what this should show, what this last discussion should illustrate, is this trade-off between simplicity and performance. Okay, so last time I was telling you there will be trade-off. So if you design your operating system for simplicity, you might go with microkernel architecture. But performance is going to be bad. Your performance will actually suffer. So now if you go for performance, you will have to go to monolithic architecture, but by no means is your operating system simple anymore. Okay, so the modern operating system try to strike a balance. They don't go at one extreme or the other. They're somewhere in between, and that is what the modular architecture does. Okay, it gives you some elements of modularity, which retains some simplicity in the kernel. You can write a module without knowing about every other piece of the kernel. Yeah, that's actually modular. And then you also try to get some performance benefits. Okay, so that's basically the kinds of trade-offs you have to make. Okay, so we're out of time, so we'll stop here. And tomorrow we'll have a lecture during the discussion section, as I mentioned.